A warning, this podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. In 2016, LeBron James willed Cleveland to its first ever NBA title. An estimated 1.3 million people packed downtown Cleveland for the parade and rally. It was tight, like hard squeezing around street corners tight. You literally couldn't move at times, packed in like sardines. And your neighbor's sweat on that June day was also your sweat. Organizers had a hard time physically getting the players during the parade to the rally site, because of all the people crammed onto the streets and sidewalks. The parade was actually delayed several times. LeBron gave a 15-minute speech complimenting every teammate.
You know, just to see this guy grow every single day.
Telling the crowd he planned to stay in Cleveland.
Shit. We'll get ready for next year.
He got the Larry O'Brien Trophy from Brown's great Jim Brown. The fireworks lit up the midday sky from atop a building near the rally site. When it ended, the party broke up. I was covering the celebration for ABC News and headed back to my car. Then I heard what sounded like a firecracker. Turned around to face it, and that's when I saw a wall of people running my way. About half a block away, a woman was shot in the leg. Police were nearby and managed to tackle a teenage gunman to the ground near a pickup truck. By that time, my iPhone was out taking video. Now, let me ask you, in that situation, what would you have done? Would you have followed the crowd and run away? Would you have sought safety? Would you have sought out the gunman or the situation? Or would you have whipped out your phone and started taking video? I probably did not make the right decision that day, and my mother would agree. In the chaos of a shooting, the first thing you need to do is be aware that something is even happening. Do you hear the gunshots? Do you hear the people? Is this serious? How close do you want to be to find out? Do you need to see a gun or victims to believe it? How long would it take you to process all of this information? And of course, you need to decide what you're going to do. Are you going to get away? Are you going to hide? You're going to try to end this threat. Some of us have run through this scenario multiple times in their heads. For me, it's a gunman entering my church on a Sunday morning. The service I go to is in the Life Center, not in the actual church itself. It's an open room with an entrance on one side, glass windows on another, classrooms behind one wall, and an emergency exit behind an actual movable wall. The room is full of movable metal and cloth chairs, not pews. I don't know who this gunman is, but immediately I see the long gun blocking the main entrance. Mentally, I can't hear shots. I'm not seeing victims, but I'm pushing my family to an emergency exit that points to the parking lot. I envision myself using the movable chairs as a shield, but also as a way to go after the gunman. See the threat on the left, point my family to the right to safety, scoop up a chair or two, and then try to end the threat to my left. At no point have I ever thought about exiting the building. At no point do I envision picking up the phone and calling 911. At no point am I stuck or am I hiding. It's just constant movement. It's always at church, never at work, never in a park, never at a store, always my church on a Sunday morning. I can't see my wife's emotions in that moment or envision the age of my children. I don't see blood or broken glass, tipped chairs or hiding people. I don't know where the pastor is. I don't see police arrive. I don't know what happens to the gunman. It's not a hero story. Nobody gets accolades. In this scenario I've run through in my head hundreds of times, I frankly don't know if I'm hit or who actually ends the threat. It's more of a mental plan, like a drawn-up football play. Look left, move people right, go left. Cade Courtley, a former Navy SEAL, created a survival guide to an active shooting situation you can find online. Here are a few things on the checklist. He says you have about 10 and a half minutes before a SWAT team arrives in these situations, but in large cities, especially with high-rises and downtown locations, it could take 20 to 30 minutes for a SWAT team to assemble. Even before a shooting takes place, he recommends you identify three exits. It could be at a mall, movie theater, your school, workplace, or place of worship. They could include doors, fences, even windows if needed, preferably facing in different directions. Second, look for any large objects where you can hide, maybe furniture, a sculpture, or a bookshelf. And third, if you're in a public place, always keep notice of the people around you. Did they look out of place? Do they have a different demeanor than others? Are they nervous? Are they sweating? He says sometimes people describe the sounds of shots as the sound of fireworks or a car backfiring. But he says if you're in an enclosed area and close enough to the gunfire, you'll have no doubt about what you're hearing. He also says you likely won't smell gunpowder. Most contemporary ammo is odorless. The first 10 seconds, he says, is crucial. If you're able to get out of immediate danger, or what he calls the kill zone, within that first 10 seconds, you have a much better chance of survival. He says those who freeze usually add to the casualty toll. But he also warns you should be calculated in your flight. Don't make yourself an easy target as you try to escape. And don't put yourself right back into danger again after you've left the so-called kill zone. He recommends staying low and finding a path to little victories, like crawling behind a potted plant, even if that puts you just a few more feet away from direct danger. The further away you get from the gunman, the faster you'll be able to move. He says you should not cover your head if you're lying on the floor. If you're a part of a group, he says you can work together to escape. Just make sure to have a plan. Perhaps one person keeps an eye on the gunman while the other looks for an exit. He recommends calling 911 when able and being able to provide information on what's happening and where, a description of the shooter if possible, including what he or she is wearing, any noticeable features, including if the person has an accent, and if you're able to determine the type of weapon being used. He advises against pondering in the moment what is happening. Instead, devise a trigger and focus on it. The calmer you are, the better. And he says when police do arrive, they'll immediately be checking people's hands for weapons, so make sure your hands are empty and exposed to prevent being suspected as the shooter. Once again, these are recommendations of a former U.S. Navy SEAL posted online. The Department of Homeland Security also offers a 13-page booklet on responding to an active shooter, laying out three basic avenues: evacuate, hide out, and take action against the shooter. Many of the recommendations are similar to what we heard in the first episode of this chapter from the FBI, as well as Cade Courtley. It does go a little more in-depth into when police arrive, how they'll be deployed, as well as training exercises for workplace staffs. All of this information is available at your fingertips right now. Have you studied it? Would you follow it? Do you even want to think about it? This is Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting, Chapter 2. He's Shooting. Here's a minute of 2024 active shooter statistics from the FBI. Among the 25 active shooters in 2024, 80% were known to the location or at least one of the victims. 20 of the shootings included just one firearm, 4 had multiple. A single handgun was used in 11 incidents, resulting in 36 casualties. A single rifle was used in 9 incidents, causing 35 casualties. And 4 incidents included multiple guns, leading to 35 casualties. 5 gunmen were apprehended at the scene, 9 at another location, 4 were killed on scene, 1 at another location, and 4 died by suicide at the scene, 2 died by suicide at another location. None of the shooters wore body armor in 2024. 1 attempted to use an improvised explosive device. Columbine remains one of the most memorable school shootings in American history, due in large part to the 24-hour cable news coverage. It also came at a time of so-called trash TV, an era of television that pitched to talk shows like Jenny Jones, Jerry Springer, and Maury. Tabloid shows like Hard Copy and Inside Edition frequently pounced on tragedies and news of the day, vilifying suspects and paying for interview subjects. Some have blamed these kinds of shows for sparking the shooting, along with music, violent video games, and movies. And in the years that have followed, Columbine remained one of the most covered events in history. There was still more to learn, more to know, more to debate. Michael Moore's Bowling for Columbine won a 2003 Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. David Cullen's Columbine peaked at number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list in 2009, and is probably one of the most notable books that examine the massacre. He would go on to write Parkland, Birth of a Movement, that would be released a decade later. But these were outsiders looking in. In 2018, 19 years after the shooting at her school, Laura Farber, now a filmmaker, completed a film from the perspective of the Columbine students, her own classmates. She was a 14-year-old freshman at Columbine on April 20th, 1999. Her film, We Are Columbine, weaves her story with the stories of other survivors as they returned to the high school and reflected on that day and the decades that have followed. Tell me a little bit about We Are Columbine.
We Are Columbine is a It's a long-form documentary. It's an hour and 18 minutes about the aftermath and the experiences of the freshman class of Columbine High School that survived the mass shooting on April 20th in 1999.
When did you decide that you wanted to make this documentary? Because you were actually in that freshman class.
Yeah. So I went to film school. And I fell in love with documentaries during my time at Columbia College in Chicago. And I just could not get my experience being at Columbine kind of out of my head. And documentaries, you know, I learned that are best told by the people who live them, the stories. So it was important to me that I, you know, if I wanted to tell a story, what do I know? Well, I know about my experience at Columbine, and that was pretty significant. And then I thought, well, I know my story. What about everybody else? And what are they doing? And how are they handling it? And then I was like, well, this is going to be a little bit bigger than just some, you know, sitting up at night and pondering. And so I just started with, you know, who do I know from the freshman class? And I started with my girlfriend, Amy, and we started talking about it. And she said, I just don't want to talk about things yet. And so this was, let's see, I graduated, let's see, 06. Technically, if you want to go back to 06, that's really when I started thinking about, you know, can I make a documentary? What story would I tell? And then it became, okay, well, my 10-year reunion was coming up. And that that made me think, well, okay, it's been a minute. And maybe people are ready to talk about it. But they weren't.
Yeah.
They weren't.
This had been back in the back of your head even by the time you graduated. That
yeah, it really was.
Telling but this just, story. Is totally. That what pushed you into filmmaking, do you think?
Probably. Yeah, I was in the film, whatever, tech department, I don't remember, camera department, whatever we called it back then, in high school. So I loved doing the morning shows, you know, in school and stuff like that. So that was always part of my curriculum. But leaping off to just say, well, I'm going to go make a documentary back then, that was just, it was a little daunting. And the subject had to be strong. And then the subjects had to be strong, and I didn't have any subjects. So I sat and I researched and I tried to figure out who would be willing to talk to me. And then I started getting a little bit more feedback from classmates and the school itself saying, well, you know what? You were there. We can talk to you. And I felt pretty special.
It's a very interesting dynamic. You being the one to tell the story, having been a part of it, you know, you can be a journalist on the outside looking in. And at that point you say, well, you know, I don't have any ties, so I can look at this, you know, without any bias or anything like that. But on the other hand, you've got access to things that the people on the outside don't. Did you really grapple with that, kind of like what your role in all of this was? Do you separate yourself, or do you put yourself into this story?
It was a tornado of all the things. It was an emotional mind game that I had to play with what I was feeling inside, just the residual trauma from that event. And then professionally, can I make a film? And then, you know, it was just all of this. And what is my role in this film? Am I going to speak in this film similar to you? You know, doing this podcast, where do I fit in and how loud do I want to be? So yeah, that was a constant battle throughout filming, throughout pre-production and all of it. But it was also important that I knew from the beginning that this wasn't going to be an objective, I guess, perspective as far as the crime. It was more about feelings and emotions and trauma. And like, what did that look like, you know, in 2012 or 2010, you know, like that long or 10 years after, what some would say was the first, you know, big mass shooting that was recorded and, sure, you know, and all that. Yeah. And all the other news outlets were doing all the other stories as well, the investigations. And so I thought, that's not what I'm here to talk about. I'm here to talk about what we went through.
You were able to extract a lot of people's memories. Was there anything when they were talking that kind of jarred some memories for you? Things that you didn't remember, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, actually I remember that.
Yeah, and I make jokes. I made a joke in the beginning that this is the most expensive therapy I could have done and undergone, because it was so cathartic, and I had no idea what was going to be uncovered, just based on my experience. And then also, I didn't know what they were going to say. I didn't know what my subjects were going to talk about. You know, I know we were all in the school that day in some capacity. We were all freshmen, but that was the extent. And when you go through something like a mass shooting, a shared trauma like that, you kind of just put everybody in the same category-ish of, well, we were there. And that's it. Like, step one, were you there? Okay, check. Now what? And I didn't know the now what, and I had to uncover that. And so, you know, I think the biggest one for me was, Amy, who I was closest with, who I was with in the cafeteria. I did not remember that when I sat down to interview her. So she's telling her story of where she was that day. And it was verbatim, my exact chain of events, my experience. And, I mean, it was enlightening. And it was really sad and tragic that, you know, I was getting my ego was getting stuck on, why didn't I remember, you know, how could I sit her in front of me, ask her these questions and not even remember we were together that day? Another layer of trauma.
Well, it's interesting talking with people who have been in these situations and the things that they remember so vividly, and then things that they don't remember at all. Even going back and watching video of a situation, I don't remember this. First of all, what are some of the things that you remember? Not something someone told you about, things that maybe you remember, whether it be sight, smell, something like that, something that's very vivid to you from that freshman year. I don't remember freshman year. I don't remember any of the classes I took. So,
well, it's funny because when I think back on my high school experience, I don't remember much other than that day. Like, I don't remember anything really before that day and what happened. So on that day, I remember running. I remember having platform shoes on that flew off. Vividly, I remember that I don't know if I kicked them off, but they were off so that I could run. And I remember running through a parking lot, running down a hill and running to a house. And I think memories are funny because we can say so confidently what we remember, but then I feel like I was also seeking validation from my classmates. Like, is this real? Did this happen? Make me feel, you know, better about this and more confident when I speak about, you know, the experience that I had.
Do you think that there is a distorted memory? I mean, you guys all kind of came together and you've patched together some things, and you probably don't even know if that's real because it's been so far. There's been so much distance. We all tell stories, and our stories get bigger and more elaborate and, you know, get more ingrained in our head. And, you know, is there concern that the stories that you guys have come together may not be how things actually unfolded?
Yes. And that's exactly what happened. You know, because then you have other classmates now that have watched, you know, We Are Columbine, and, you know, maybe after a screening or in some other capacity, I'll get a note that says, hey, I remember when Gus said this, but I don't remember. I was in that room and that didn't happen. It's like, well, guess what? You remember what you remember, and he remembers what he remembers. And that's that. That's just kind of, that's life. I mean, you know, I didn't put too much weight in it of like, you know, how truthful, you know, I want to be truthful to this, but it's also somebody's experience. You can't fact check that. So it took a lot of the pressure off me in a sense at some point during filming where I was like, you just got to let them go, you know, let them tell their story and listen and learn. And that's what I did.
Did you get a lot of feedback from former classmates after?
Yes. And even still, to this day, I'm getting feedback from former classmates and from the ones that have gone to see it, you know, because sometimes a lot of us that went to Columbine just kind of want to, that happened, I moved on, I'm not going to watch anything about it because I don't need somebody telling me what I already went through. So there's, you know, there's still some of that.
Do you feel, though, that there's a connection between everyone having been through that experience? I mean, did you unite? I don't really talk or converse with many people from high school anymore. I don't know if that having that shared experience brought you guys together in any ways, or did everyone just kind of scatter to their parts of the country?
Yeah, no, I think definitely. Well, and for the freshman class, we united so strong for a solid 2 to 3 years. 4 years, if you want to be generous, you know, until we graduated, we were all together and formed a sense of community. And then even outside of that, I just happened to leave. I left and I did scatter. I went to another state, went to college, but a lot of people stayed. And so, you know, I don't know if they get together, you know, if they're still high school friends and they're getting together and they're talking about Columbine, probably not. But I think we're in a position now where maybe there's more comfort there in talking about it. So I'm grateful for that.
What are we, 6 years after it came out? 7 years after it came out?
Yeah, it's been a minute. 2019 is when it came out.
I mean, what do you think about it now? Is it something you're proud of? Is it something that you wish you had done differently? Is it something that you just like, okay, I got that project done with and now I'm moving on to the next thing? What do you think about?
No, I wish I could. Well, the film industry is funny in itself. That whole industry is silly, but especially when you're independent. And no, it's definitely I'm proud of that film because I stayed true to what I promised my subjects. And that was really important to me, and having integrity in filmmaking. You know, I think, of course, always you can look back on your stuff and go, what could I have done differently? Yes, there are some things that I probably would have changed if I could go back. But I also sometimes I think, gosh, we could do another one. You know, there were so many stories from that day that to focus on. And at some point you just have to pick your lane. So I am proud of it, but I'm sad, you know, it's sad. It's sad that we're still talking about this. I was shocked for a while and now I'm not shocked anymore. And now it's just, you know, what are we going to do about it and what can be done?
When you think about you were in the cafeteria, you said at the time, so did you hear gunshots? Were you close to anything or were you kind of hunkering down from what you had heard from other people?
Yeah, I don't remember hearing gunshots. I heard a custodian with keys on, a frequent face that we saw regularly in the cafeteria, came running in saying, everyone get under the tables. And at 14, I do what I'm told.
Sure.
And you get under and you don't, you know, you just don't know. It's literally, you're just frozen with fear and chaos, and you're under there. But I do remember having some interactions with classmates under the table of all of us looking at each other like, what? Now what? And then running. And then I remember running and people running past me. And then we all, well, I'm going to get up too. It's like a herd, you know, in a stampede, you run. I do remember hearing somebody had a gun before I left the cafeteria because otherwise I don't, you know, I don't think we would have been running for, you know, anything else other than something pretty scary that we'd never heard before.
It's so weird because the actions your whole class, the whole school took, it's been, put under a microscope for security purposes, psychological purposes. I mean, you guys were very unique from that perspective. And I think now looking at it, you don't duck unless the person's in the room, right? You look for the exit and you get the heck out of there. So, I mean, at some point, someone decided we need to get out of here and get away from this building, but there's something that's got to trigger your mind. You're 14 years old. You're like, I can't leave school. I'm supposed to be here. If I run out of school, I'm going to get in trouble,
Big time. Big
And
time.
so I guess my question to you, and maybe you don't really remember your mindset at all, but is there anything that you would have done differently, looking at your 14-year-old self now in that moment? I mean, no, with the knowledge you had in that moment.
I think flight, fright, you know, that fear that took over and you just go, you know, with the herd. And yeah, I don't think I, you know, not even like, well, I'm gonna stand up and I'm gonna take on whatever's behind, you know, this unknown door. That's A, not in my being anyway. But no, it was get run. Run.
Eventually human instincts take
Yeah,
over.
it really is. I'm just grateful that I did, to be honest.
Yeah, and you probably weren't even thinking. You probably just your body probably just took over, and that's probably why you don't remember some of it as well, right?
Totally. And then and but still thinking, also, you know, fearful, but still thinking, fearful that I'm going to get in trouble if I don't. You know, if I leave this building during school hours,
Right.
and then even down the hill, like I'm running away from the school, but like we got to go back. And then when we got to the house to safety, I guess we got to go back. Like, you know, I have a test at 3.
This is like a little interruption in your life, not a life-changing event at that point. It's not until later when you realize how big of an event this was.
Right. And I, you know, and I think it, I always go back to now because I'm, you know, it's 26 years later, you know, and I put myself in the positions of people, survivors now that go through it. And, you know, like, what are they thinking now? I know what I was thinking back then. We know so much more, you know, than we did in 99.
What do you think when you see these situations play out then? Are you angry, frustrated, scared? Does it take you back?
Some specific ones do. Some specific events
Also
are
the
more
school ones,
troubling.
probably.
Definitely school, yeah. And you know, if, you can't just pick one because that's awful. But I remember vividly both Parkland and Sandy Hook really kind of still just put my stomach in knots because of where we. Then I fast forward. I'm like, look where we are now. Look at this. And I do get frustrated. And I don't like living in this feeling of, you know, not hopelessness, but kind of where you feel like, okay, these are all really good solutions. And we've worked on public safety so much and law enforcement response. And then, you know, being on the mental health side and making sure we're checking in on everybody. But it's like there's still a disconnect between all of it. And I get really sad because that's when the hopelessness sets in, where it's like you just want to wave a wand, you know, and be like, this, can we fix this? Because it's not gonna get better, it's gonna get worse.
Is there
Clearly.
anything that you think we in the media could do better? Is there something
Oh,
that maybe we're doing wrong?
now, no, back then, yes. I think
Right.
lessons were definitely learned. And that was part of another reason why I wanted to make the film as well, because there was some deep-rooted anger with the media and how how they respond to tragedies. And then
shoving microphones in people's faces
middle
of
Stalking and literally talking to victims right after a traumatic situation is like, I mean, that's the most important is.
And in most cases, they agree and haven't even processed what it is that they experienced.
Right. And so when I hear those sound bites of like, well, we just ran and we were so scared. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, it puts me right back there of like, I just want to put my arms around them and hug them because that's what they need is not the microphone, not the interview. They need a hug.
So do you think you're going to advance this story a little bit more or do you think you've kind of put it to bed?
I put that to bed. I still think there's always a place for conversation around the film and around this topic, always. But no, I'm definitely moving on to my next mission.
What's that?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm just saying it out loud. You know, films, if you don't have money, Ryan, they take a long time.
Yeah.
No, honestly, it's, I'm going the animal route. I'm a vegan.
So you're not eating the animals.
I'm not eating the animals and I'm trying to get to a more sustainable way of life. Zoos, look out.
Where can people find We Are Columbine?
You can find We Are Columbine on Apple TV, Amazon Prime, YouTube, Google Play, Fandango at Home, Tubi, and Freebie?
No, not a Blockbuster Video.
Yeah.
Can people follow you on social media?
They can, but it's a pretty vegan website with only stories about animal abuse and animal agriculture. So if you want to follow me, I'm on Instagram on Laura Farbs.
We've posted a link to the trailer for We Are Columbine at WGNRadio.com.